yourselves a hand for braving this weather and sticking it out. Come on. It's now time. It's my pleasure to introduce our incredible, wonderful AA speaker, K.H. Let's give her a hand.
There is definitely some kind of metaphor for the Al-Anon for the sun coming out when the AA speaker comes on. It's like the alcoholic always gets away with it somehow. Speaking of which, my name is Kay. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much, Diana, for inviting me to your new hometown to speak today. My sobriety date is June 24th of 2011, and I'm coming up on 14 years in June, which is kind of crazy. And I think about that, it seems like just yesterday, you know, when 14 years ago at this time, I had some big ass problems in my life. And I'll tell you how that happened. I'm a nice Irish Catholic girl from Boston, Massachusetts. And like most of us from Boston. Oh, and Lisa, you're from New York, right? East Coast girls. Woo, woo, woo. like most people from, most of my people, a seat in AA is basically our birthright. And I definitely earned mine. And so did my father and his father before him and all the priests and nuns in our family that that just did their thing. And some of us got sober and some of us did not. My dad, well, first of all, my first experiences with alcohol were my uncle, Father John Hanley, he's the pastor of a parish in Lowell, Mass. And he would every once a month for whatever occasion it was, we would go to my grandmother's house and he would say Mass and you know the drinks would come out and you know people would be drinking during Mass because you can do that at grandma's house, not necessarily at church. Although I'm sure people did. And you know, after Mass, we'd have dinner, and adults would have more drinks, and then Uncle Danny would get behind the piano, and everyone would be singing and laughing and busting each other's balls, and it was just, it was great fun. And I, for whatever reason, like, knew that the alcohol had something to do with it, that, like, the drinks were giving people a louder laugh, a more in-tune voice, you know, whatever the case may be. I made a strong connection between family and happiness and booze. my father's alcoholism escalated, and you know, as it does, you know, if you're the real thing, at some point the progression of the disease is going to it's gonna get you. And my father started going into rehabilitation centers in like 1984 or something like that. And in that time, my mom became an Al-Anon ninja, and she decided that I, her eldest daughter, also had a problem with booze, and so I should go to rehab too. So in 1986, I got sober. I was in high school, and I was sober for senior prom. I went to, a lot of kids my age in Boston at that time were getting sober, so so I went to prom with a kid from the Southie Projects who was also sober, and he was my age. I graduated from high school, sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I, you know, sponsored teenagers, and I turned 21 sober, And then just around 22, I was like, nah, I probably overreacted. And I went out. And I went out for 20 years. And in that time, so it talks in our literature about, you know, being able to, you know, stop or moderate, or like stopping when you're just a potential alcoholic. I mean, it was very obvious that, like, I could not drink for shit and I shouldn't do it ever. But I wasn't, like, a daily drinker. I wasn't even a monthly drinker. I mean, my mom was, like, really strict, religious, Catholic mom, so I didn't get to do very much. But whenever I drank, I had no idea what was going to happen. And I would drink piggishly. And the first time I drank, my older cousin took me to the St. Paddy's Day Parade. I think I was like 12 or 13 years old. St. Paddy's Day Parade in Southie. And her and her older friends were already drinking. And they, I'm so sorry that I'm going to do this to you, but I'm going to tell you what we drank that day. Peppermint schnapps and Pepsi. And I blacked out. I didn't even make it to the parade. And my older cousin and her friends, like, dumped me at, you know, Savin Hill Station. And I know I'm talking like you all know where all these places are, but, you know. And I think about it now, like, if I were to see, like, a 13-year-old, like, child, like, passed out, covered in vomit on a train, like, just, like, but no one, like, stopped to help me or anything. Like, I somehow made it home, got caught, you know, and that was, like, I was, like, wow. I mean, it was horrible. I was miserable. I was so sick the next day. I blacked out. I didn't remember. My father told me that he, like, filmed me, and, like, I didn't remember what I did, but I knew that whatever it was horrible, and it shouldn't be filmed. And I doubt he did that because we didn't have, like, a video camera or anything. But I believed him. my father was sober. He was sober. Well, he has his own story. I went out for, as I said, 20 years. And in that time, I knew that I was an alcoholic because I had been in AA. And, but I thought, oh, the trick is to just, like, if you know you're an alcoholic and you know that you drink every day, and then you go into the music business, you can just do whatever you want. You can drink all the time. You can drink at lunch. You can drink in the morning. You can get in fights at the bar at night. And no one, and, like, you don't get fired for that. You, like, get rewarded for that. So that was the trick. Just, like, acknowledge that you are an alcoholic and become a musician, which is what I did. So I probably would have stopped a lot, you know, long before I did, were it not for the career that I chose. I got married. We had two beautiful children. We moved from Boston to LA, which is something I swore I would never, ever, ever do. But I didn't want to tour in a band anymore. I wanted to, like, go behind the scenes and, like, write for other things and produce music. And, you know, I had, like, a thing that I really wanted to do. And moving here seemed like the right choice for me and my young family. My kids were 4 and 7 months at the time. So, you know, I still hadn't hit the progression. I was having some problems, but, like, getting pregnant and having, you know, being a mother of, like, young kids, you know, I was able to, you know, it talks in the book, being able to stop or moderate if you have sufficient consequences or if you were faced with it. And I just really was able to kind of, and not for nothing, I mean, I still drank every day, but, like, I drank a half a bottle of wine every day, which for me is just, like, that's breakfast. So, like, so it was, you know, but I had no problems. It wasn't affecting my life in any significant way. Until it did. And, like my father before me, the progression began to kick in around 2006 or 7 when I had a little, I stopped off for, I mean, booze is definitely my drug of choice. I'm just like a garden variety drunk, that's what I am, to my marrow. But I also love everything. I'm just like, just give it to me. It's garbage. I'll ask you what it is later. And I love to change the way I feel. I love to feel the shift into something else. Like, this feeling that I have right now is not good enough. I need, like, this feeling will be better, or that feeling will be better. And I still suffer from that occasionally, not as much, and I definitely don't treat that feeling with booze and drugs anymore. But I had a stop off with, had a significant drug problem for a couple of years, and I got clean from that particular drug. And what happened at that point, that was in 2006 or 7, I had become accustomed to taking my medicine in the morning so that I wouldn't be sick. So I wasn't doing that anymore. But I still kind of like had that, I felt like I needed something first thing in the morning. So just to get to the point, what ended up happening was thanks, Diana.
Thank you.
I would have this fight with myself in the morning. We moved to a house in Studio City so we could walk the kids to school. And, you know, there's a great public school in Studio City. And my son was in, like, first grade, and I think my daughter was in the fourth. And in the morning, I would be like, you don't have to have a drink before you walk the kids to school. Just wait until after you get back from walking the kids to school and have a drink then. And, you know, sometimes I could do it. Sometimes I couldn't wait. And then most of the time I couldn't wait. And then at some point, you know how like we draw a line in the sand, the line that we're just never going to cross. And then we cross it, and we're like, whoa, but I'll never do that. And then we do that, and then we, you know, keep redrawing the line and come up with justifications for why we do that. And I really had no justification for why. I mean, I could explain to myself why I would erase other lines, but to me, it was like walking my kids to school drunk at 7:30 in the morning seemed unreasonable. And it was something that I could not stop doing. And at that point, my husband started finding bottles of, like, vodka around that, like, at one point I was, like, hiding a bottle of vodka. And this is crazy because, like, I never had to lie about my drinking. I never had to, like, if I wanted to drink at lunch, I drank at lunch. Like, I was a drinking lady. And, like, that's what I was known to be. So, like, for me to be hiding my drinking, like, this was different. Something was different. And I remember I was hiding my vodka in a boot in the back of my closet. And my husband was looking for something. And I see him, like, kind of on his knees in my closet. And he's backing out. And he's, like, with a handle of vodka. He's like, "Kay, what the fuck is this?" I'm sorry for this. I shouldn't be swearing. And I was like, "Oh, I don't know." Like, I wasn't ready with a lie. I was like, I don't know. And he was like, and I think that he didn't want to know either. Like, I think he was so, like, new, but just did not want to know. And so, so we just were like, okay, we're just not going to talk about that again. And, and things went, so that was adorable compared to what started to happen after that, which was like not good. So one night after a particularly horrific incident in my home that was witnessed by the kids, the next morning I woke up and my husband asked me to leave. This was in October of 2010. And he said, "I've called your parents." He called my mommy and daddy. I was 40-something years old, getting tattled on. And he's like, I bought you a plane ticket. You can get on the plane. You don't have to get on the plane, but you can't stay here because I have to protect myself and the kids from you. And this is, like, I'm an A student. I'm a perfectionist. I'm like, there's nothing I want more than to please you and to make you think that everything is, like, totally cool. Like, I have been really, my part-time job was talking myself out of a jackpot. Like, I was really good at that. And all of a sudden, it's like, oh, that's not working anymore, to the extent that I'm being kicked out of my home. And so at first I was like, I'm not. And then, half a second later, I was like, I'm going to die. And I wasn't necessarily bummed about that. Like, I kind of was like, that would be fine with me. But I had made such a mess of everything that, like, and I just didn't want to die with things such a mess. I wanted a chance to, like, clean it up and, like, get an A again. And so, anyway, that also did not work out the way I hoped it would. I went home, went to detox, went to rehab, came back to LA, sober living, relapsed, ended up in a, it was a nightmare for, I was institutionalized, hospitalized, I think 7 times in the next 7 months before I finally got sober in June of 2011. And by then, I was not allowed to see my children alone anymore. My husband, who, you know, he could have, if he wanted to, hurt me as badly as I had hurt him. He could have gotten the courts involved. Whatever reason, he decided not to do that. And so I just kind of like signed a contract with my family that I would, after my last rehab, that I would not return to LA for a couple of months, that I would come home with 3 months sober, and that I would go live with mommy and daddy at the age of 43 on Cape Cod in the fall, and I needed to do that. I was absolutely broken, and my writing partner said, I don't want to work with you until you're 2 years sober. And I was like, 2 years sober? That's a long time. You won't work with me again for 2 years? And it's funny because it worked out that the project that we had been working on after my last relapse we didn't get offered the job back. We didn't go back to work on that project, or we got the call when I was 18 months sober, which is wild to me, like how the universe is like, just like, if I just don't try and control things, how the universe is conspiring for my success, you know? And like, I still cannot wrap my head around that. If I were writing the script for my life, I would like come back from my last rehab and like do the 3 months, and then I'd come back and then I'd apologize to everybody and just like get my job back, get my car back, get my career back, get my marriage back, and like within 6 months it would all be done, and then we'd all be just moving along. And it's like, it did not go down that way. It was like I actually lost everything. I lost my marriage, I lost my career, I lost my relationship with my children. I'm about to lose my head, I think. Thank you, Kostaic. Woo! All of my worst fears came true. And if you're a newcomer, I'm sorry to tell you this part of my story, but stuff actually got worse in the first year and a half, and that was because, and that's not everyone's story. Some people like really have that pink cloud of like they get sober and like their life gets better right away. That was not me. That did not happen to me. But there was one thing I did correctly, which I got a sponsor. Who? How much time do I have, Diana? 7 minutes? 17 minutes? Oh, okay. All right. I can get it done. I'll tell the story about my first sponsor then. So when I came back to LA, after, and I had my three months of sobriety, I guess, and someone introduced. I was going to Third and Gardner in Hollywood. It's 11:30 a.m. on Sunday mornings, and someone introduced me to this woman and said, "Oh, like Louisa should be your sponsor." And I was like, "Okay, fine with me," you know. But I looked at Louisa. I mean, I was, like I said, 43, marriage falling apart, kids not wanting to, kids afraid of me, not able to spend time with them alone. Like, and she was a 25-year-old, like techno DJ, who like was from she was like a rich kid from Manhattan who had a coke problem, and she was like, and I was just like a booze bag from Boston, like 43 years old. Anyway, suffice it to say, we had nothing in common at all, but she had me meet her at the Tropical in Silver Lake at 6 o'clock every Tuesday night. And we started going through the book, and then we'd sit for an hour, and I'd get like a Cuban sandwich and like five coffees, and then we'd go to the 12 and 12 meeting in the back room at 7 p.m. So I did this every, and one of the things that happened just because of that, and this is kind of like instructive of how AA worked for me, like I was never on time. Like if I said I was going to meet you somewhere, like I would, but like I wouldn't be on time. And you'd have to remind me like 20 times, and I'd forget your birthday, I'd forget where I was supposed to meet you, I would forget, you know, I just wasn't thoughtful of other people's time, and I wasn't dependable, you know, and so having to drive from the Valley to Silver Lake at 6 p.m. on Tuesday night, like, I had to learn how to budget my time. And it sounds like a who cares? Like, duh, other people, you know, it's rush hour. You can figure that out. I really could not figure that out. I did not know how to be on time for things. And I had to learn how to care about someone else's time because she was making time for me every Tuesday night. So I learned how to be on time, like, big whoop. It was a big whoop for me. But another thing started to happen, which was, oh, and the other thing about Louisa, the reason that I wanted to work with her was because, like, she, the way I like to describe her is that she looked like, when I met her, she looked like she was just, like, had this shimmering orb around her, and that, like, she just put her peaceful, empty head on a pillow at night and just fell asleep, and, like, and I was like, oh my God, I totally want that. Like, I want it. Like, to me, the idea of just, like, falling asleep with an empty, quiet brain was like, wow. Yeah, I mean, that was, like, real. Like, that was sort of, like, pie in the sky to me. And so I would meet her, and that was the only thing I did right, is I didn't drink, and I met Louisa every Tuesday night. And then and we got to the fourth step, and she said, and now I had been going to meetings over on the east side because I thought that was like where my people were, like the rock and roll people and the artsy fartsy people. And I was like, I don't have any friends. Why don't I have any friends? And it's because they weren't my people. But I didn't know that until my sponsor said, I'm moving to Paris to pursue my DJ dreams, and I can't sponsor you anymore. And I was like, oh my God. So so she left, and she moved to Paris, and I was like, damn. And I heard this woman speak at, I decided to go to a women's meeting in the Valley, and like, just suck it up, go to a meeting in the Valley. Blah. And and I heard this woman named Barbara Diner speak, and I was like, what the? And, like, I just made a beeline for her after the meeting, and I was just like, will you sponsor me? And she was like, oh, honey, I would be honored to sponsor you. And the next thing you know, I'm not going to meetings in West Hollywood or on the East Side anymore. I'm going to all meetings in the Valley, and I'm going to all women's meetings. And then the next thing you know, I'm like telling on myself at this women's meeting, and Diana, you were like a regular at that meeting, and I'll never forget you for that, because it was like it the night that changed my life happened at that meeting, when I put up my hand at this women's meeting Wednesday night at Moore Park in Studio City, and I had just been coming to meetings and like sitting in the back and just like not, you know, and like don't look at me, and but not like the don't look at me, but like please look at me. It was like don't look at me, don't talk to me, don't. I really did mean it. It wasn't being coy. And I put up my hand and I said that, you know, I said I'm really lonely. I'm a year and a half sober. I don't have any friends, and I don't, you know, I lost my marriage, and I'm in a relationship, or I was just in a relationship with a horrible person who I broke up with, and I just called the IRS and told on myself, and which is a whole other story. But it was an important part of the story, and I don't know what to do. So you know what happened. It was like after the meeting, all the women were just like, vroom, and they immediately put me in the door as the greeter for that meeting. And within like a couple of weeks, I knew everybody's name. Everyone knew my name. I was just like, hey, blah, 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 and like hugging everybody. And like, and all, it was like instantaneous when I really, really grabbed hold of this program, when I allowed myself to be seen by other women in Alcoholics Anonymous. It changed everything almost overnight. And not to say that, I mean, circumstances in my life didn't change overnight, but the way I perceived myself changed, and I saw I had hope for the first time. And Barbara Diner did not make me do my fourth step over again, thank God, because it took everything I had not to. I'm not thinking about this at all. I'm just totally fine. So she let me do my, she just did the fifth step. She heard my fourth step. We did the fifth step together. And then we did six and seven. And that is about, you know, of course it's about your character defects and all of that. But the thing that absolutely blew my mind was like I had no, I, you know, I always thought like that inner child work and all that, like, you know, sort of like la la fairy stuff was like, I just wasn't into it, and I just didn't believe in it. And through six and seven, I was able to see that, you know, that the thing that had, you know, not led to my drinking, but contributed to the behavior that took me down, was all rooted in, you know, these survival skills that I had learned as a kid in my alcoholic home. And not, you know, like one of the first things I learned was like, don't make too much noise, don't rock the boat, don't poke the bear. You don't want Dad to get angry. Just like make sure that everybody else is quiet too, because we don't want Dad to get pissed. And like, and so I was a perfectionist, and I was like, I was. This is really exciting, actually. I swear, a tornado. I was saying to Diana, it looks like a tornado could really literally break out at any second. How fun would that be? We would remember each other forever. We'd always have this moment. Remember when we almost got killed by that tornado in Castaic? Next to fire camp? Thank you. I'll just wrap it up, maybe. Okay, I will wrap it up. Okay. Thanks so much for sitting here, you guys. This is like amazing. I don't know if I would do that for you, but I. Yes, I would. I would go anywhere for Alcoholics Anonymous, literally. What was I saying? Oh, yeah, my inner child. Yeah, so I, anyway. Oh, God. So I really accepted this idea that my character, these character defects, that, and not for nothing, like, being, like, an Irish Catholic, like, I couldn't wait to dig into, like, the fourth column of my fourth step and just really dig into all the ways that everything was my fault. Like, I had the opposite problem of a lot of people that I had, like, everything was everybody else's fault. No, everything was my fault, and I couldn't wait to, like, really just, like, figure out even more ways that things were my fault and that I was terrible and that, like, I deserved everything bad that happened to me. And which is also equally, like, that is egomania. That is dishonesty too. It's just as dishonest as, because if everything is my fault, then all I have to do is, like, oh, I'll just apologize and then we're done, right? We don't have to, it's over, right? And that is not going to work either. So for me, it was like working in, 6 and 7 were like the magic beans for me, and working on, you know, these, and I heard somebody call them character defaults. Like, these are the behaviors that I default to when I'm in fear, when I'm hungry, angry, lonely, tired, when I'm, like, at diminished capacity. Like, I will act a fool. I will, you know, get mad at people. I will lash out at people. I will do things that lead me to have to make amends later. To me, this all made sense, that my perfectionism created dishonesty in my life, like a deep, deep, like in there, like cellular, biological, imperative dishonesty that kind of controlled my life in the interest of being perfect and of, like, making sure that no one knew what was really going on. And I began to, like, lie about everything and constructing this house of cards. One thing that I don't have in my, that I have such an appreciation for, like, I don't have any secrets. I literally don't have one single secret. And I mean, like, there's stuff that I won't tell my husband, but, like, but that's because, like, there are certain things that is not for him. But there's, for everything in, like, there is someone who knows. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's nothing that I'm keeping from. Not every bit of information is for everybody in my life. And I once heard with this woman, Quincy, say this at a meeting, like, I don't bring the crazy where it doesn't belong. And what that means to me is that, like, I don't try to work stuff out with, like, if I'm having trouble with a friendship or I don't bring that first to the person who I'm having, because I don't really know what the truth is. I really need someone else's eyes and ears, like, on the problem. Because I'm dumb. Like, I will just, like, I will make up stories about what's happening, what is going on in a situation. And that was also what I learned in what 6 and 7 is all about, is about humility. And humility is not contrary to my earlier belief. It's not humiliation. It is reality. Like, humility is seeing you for who you really are, seeing me for who I really am, and seeing the situation for what it really is. And for me, finding that reality, that truth, that is where my higher power is. Anytime that I don't say the thing that I just, like, want to pop off on you because whatever, you know, and I don't, and I just, like, pause, that's where my higher power lives. Whenever I pause, that is, you know, God's will. As opposed to, like, acting on that, like, hot feeling in my belly of, like, I have to say it. I have to do it. I have to whatever, eat it, whatever the case may be. It's, like, that hot feeling of, like, urgency, that's my will. That's how I know. That's my hack for, like, how I know it's my will. It's, like, if it has to get done right now, it's definitely not God's will. So, just to kind of wrap things up, that marriage that I talked about did not And now I'm going to cry because I'm looking at Gemma, who looks like a trucker in a... that marriage did not survive with my husband, the father of my kids. But what I always try to say is that the marriage didn't survive, but my family did. And we have a new version of our family. He has a partner, that he married, and she is a stepmom to my children. And she's a good one. And, like, we don't hang out. We're not, like, friends and stuff. But we have, like, this warm relationship that, like, we communicate with each other. And, like, and it's not, it's, I don't bring, like, if I'm having a problem with them, like, I don't bring it straight to them. Because I do, frequently. But not frequently, sometimes. And then I met someone, I reconnected with a former colleague. Someone, you know, a man who's a normie, and he's had the same six-pack of beer in our fridge for, like, literally someone bought him his favorite beer that, like, you can't ever get or whatever, and it's been in the fridge for, like, a year. And I'm just like, when are you going to drink your favorite beer? But you know what? The beer in the fridge, like, I make fun of him for it, but, like, honestly... My goal in everything is just that feeling of neutrality, of like I look at in neutrality in everything really, but it started with booze. Like I see it, I acknowledge it, I'm not mad at it, I'm not scared of it. I just like I kind of don't care. It just doesn't. It's a nothing to me, and any time that I'm in obsession, I know that there's work that I can do to find a space of neutrality because I did it with the thing that I was more obsessed with than I could ever, ever, ever be obsessed with anything, and that was like my best friend, booze. Like, if I could find a place of neutrality around that, using the tools of, you know, the 12 steps of AA, and my relationships with the people in this program, I can do it for anything. And I'm just really happy to be here, and, you know, Diana and I go back such a long way, and I'm just so grateful for you kind of leading the way for me, and, you know, in all of the ways. And if you're new, coming back, if you're hurting, if you're great, I'm just really glad you're here, and I'm glad to be doing it with you. All right, thanks.